Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, one of the most intrepid and I think effective organizations on the side of the good guys is Judicial Watch. It has done incalculably important work in exposing and holding accountable government officials and agencies that have all too often gone rogue and engaged in activity that, if not actually criminal, is certainly malfeasant. A man who has helped Judicial Watch in much of that important work is the Director of Research and Investigation at that organization. He is Chris Farrell, a great American who has served his country in uniform as well as now in his post at Judicial Watch. Notably, he is a military intelligence officer, United States Army, now retired. He is an extraordinary asset for the cause of freedom and always a great and welcome guest here. Chris, good to have you. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you.
Well, I think you have been engaged in various aspects of this caper, but I just would like to get your overall assessment of what we have found out so far in connection with Andrew McCabe and Peter Strzok and Bruce Ohr and the rest of the cast of characters who have begun to emerge as the henchmen of a deep state operation against the president. Donald Trump as candidate first and now as president.
Well, the McCabe gang, and that's how I choose to think about them, Strzok or the rest of them, the McCabe gang is just that. And so you have a person like McCabe who, you know, from a number of different FBI sources, friends of mine who I know who are both recently retired agents and even some folks who are still actively doing their thing. McCabe deliberately set out to recruit sort of like-minded persons who, you know, were buddies, pals. And it's everything from political ideologues who kind of march in lockstep with him to just useful idiots, people who were go along to get along, who saw that they could climb or at least kind of ride his coattails as he ascended the ranks at the FBI. And so he kind of developed his own little posse, his own little gang of people. And that includes folks like Ohr and Strzok, and I'm sure a handful of other people that we don't even know their names yet, but we will. So that's really sort of the setup, right? And so these guys are all kind of in it together, and they're willing to do whatever they need to do to advance their agenda. It's a gang, and the McCabe gang has now been identified.
And to the extent that that's so, would you say, based on, again, information that's available, though it's hardly all there is, I'm sure, out there, that these folks were operating in a manner that was quite possibly criminal in terms of their use of intelligence techniques and assets and violating the rights of American citizens and otherwise bringing their offices to bear in a manner that was, as I say, at odds with the mission of the agencies, notably the Justice Department and the FBI, to protect the law and to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, an oath to which all of these individuals swore allegiance.
No doubt. Look, these guys have investigative guidelines. They have procedures and processes that they have to follow. They have some discretion, obviously. I mean, we give them extraordinary power in the form of, you know, a badge and a gun and life or death decisions that are granted them. So we place that special trust and confidence in them. Nonetheless, they have certain investigative techniques and procedures that they have to follow. Abusing those for either personal gain or some other weird, you know, political objective is unlawful. It's a crime. And it can be viewed in sort of either the misdemeanor sense of just sort of a petty abuse of one's authority. And it's a silly example, but it illustrates what I'm getting at. And that is abusing your authority to run someone's record or to run a license plate or to check an address or and that's sort of a street-level investigative process that normally is constrained or controlled in some way. You just can't do it because you want to. But let's say a guy does. All right, is that the end of the world? Probably not. But it is at sort of the misdemeanor level, an abuse of the investigative process.
Then there's the higher order.
Yeah, then there's getting phony FISA warrants, right? That's a whole other...
Based on Russian intelligence that you've solicited and the like, yeah. Listen, before we run out of time, Chris, I did want to ask you about another aspect of the Judicial Watch portfolio in which, again, you guys have done unbelievably impressive work, often putting to shame congressional investigators, to say nothing of the press, namely the whole matter of Hillary Clinton's criminal conduct, among other things, with respect to the expropriation of records and documents and her mishandling of her emails and servers and all of that. You had an important find recently, and I wanted to ask you about the State Department allowing her to walk out the door and her sidekick, Huma Abedin, a very dubious character, with documents that almost certainly have been shredded now and should be in the public domain. What have you found on that regard?
Yeah, there was an extraordinary agreement reached between the State Department and Hillary Clinton and her, as you mentioned, Huma Abedin, perhaps others, perhaps even Cheryl Mills and others. But where they let them walk with, really abscond with federal government records. And it's remarkable in that in no other circumstance or case would anyone ever be allowed to take the materials that we're talking about to include, I believe it's a couple of boxes, I guess, that were identified or marked as, you know, Muslim organization outreach and cooperation or
engagement. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the notion that somehow government officials can grab official files and walk out the door without consequence is mind-boggling. It's never been done before. Hopefully, it will never be done again. But that's just not within the discretion of or the purview of, you know, some associate or assistant deputy secretary saying, sure, go ahead, take all your stuff.
Yeah. Do we know who did that, Chris Farrell?
My guess, and this is just a guess, I don't know right now, my guess is that it was the Assistant or Deputy Secretary of State Kennedy, but I don't know that for certain.
That would be my guess, too. So I've heard Andy McCarthy, a friend of ours and former federal prosecutor, observing that the handling of this and so many other aspects of the Hillary Clinton criminal activity portfolio stands in such bizarre contrast to the kind of treatment that Donald Trump is getting that any fair-minded person, as he put it on Sean Hannity's show yesterday, would come to the conclusion something is seriously wrong here. Chris Farrell, you've experienced government from the inside. You've been involved in counterintelligence. You've watched closely this kind of behavior in your present post at Judicial Watch. Would you concur with that? And if so, what are the implications of it?
Andy McCarthy is a great guy, and he also happens to be 110% correct. The implications are that, you know, laws are for the little people and that there's this separate sort of system of not just enforcement, but even sort of discretion, right? The what is deemed permissible and waiverable and, well, that's okay for you, for the Clintons. And it is enormously corrosive. It destroys the concept of equal justice under the law. And no other federal government employee, none, anywhere, would be granted these extraordinary, you know, waivers and turn a blind eye, et cetera, that the Clintons have. And the photographic negative of that is the hysteria with respect to President Trump over nothing. No one is yet to be able to articulate what the criminal predicate is for Mr. Miller's special counsel investigation.
But he's bound and determined to come up with something before it's over, isn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, it's Stalinist. When you investigate people until you find a crime, that's not how we work in this country. It's the polar opposite of our entire criminal justice system.
Especially with double standards in terms of the rule of law. Chris Farrell, again, I cannot say how highly I appreciate your work at Judicial Watch and that of your colleagues. It is simply of incalculable importance to the Republic. A subject we'll turn to again with Diana West in just a moment, but let me say again, farewell. Thank you so much and great work in 2017. We'll look forward to continue our collaboration in the new year. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Diana West, up next.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Diana West is in the house, I'm very pleased to say. Diana is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist and blogger par excellence. You can find her writings these days at dianawest.net, also frequently at the Daily Caller and in other outlets. She is the author of two superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, and a weekly contributor to our program, for which we are most grateful. It has been a great run this year, Diana. We're looking forward to 2018, doing much the same with you and more. Welcome back.
Yes, yes. Season's greetings.
Thank you, and to you too. Let me ask you about the topics that we were discussing with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch a moment ago, Diana, involving what you have described as the espionage machine party, by which I take it you mean the Democratic Party of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and the conspiracy in which it now seems clear the Department of Justice and FBI, at least some members of both of those institutions in senior positions, engaged in to, as you put it, or Joe DiGenova, I guess, put it, and you quoted, frame the President of the United States. Talk a little bit about your thoughts on those subjects.
Well, yes. Well, this phrase actually is recently brought to mind by Peter Strzok. This was right from one of his texts. He was discussing himself as a single party voter in a text to his girlfriend, Lisa Page, the adulterous affair, the other official that we've been discussing. He was discussing himself as a single party voter, and that party, he teasingly, one would suspect, tells her is the espionage machine party.
Ah, so this is Strzok's turn of phrase. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes, this is Strzok's turn of phrase, which I found quite chilling.
Which presumably also is what he's thinking about when he's talking about his insurance policy for dealing with the prospect of the president actually getting elected.
He was actually talking, I believe, about a recent Republican debate in which now President Trump, I believe he's referring to President Trump, referenced to Edward Snowden, and he was very heartened by this. He felt that Trump was calling for Snowden's death, essentially, and that pleased him. And because he was a single party voter and his party is the espionage machine party, which conjures up the entire deep state surveillance state complex. So this is why I found this so highly significant and something that has not been teased out.
No, I appreciate, again, your clarifying this. And so tease out the degree to which you think it's now already clear, let alone what might yet come out of hopefully congressional oversight investigations, including the interview yesterday with Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, who seems to have been implicated in some of this insurance policy work, to frame the president of the United States.
Yes, I don't think that this can be overstated how staggeringly important this piece, this sort of window we're getting into the machinations of this security state complex. This is the deepest, the most dire threat I can think of that our republic has ever sustained, that we are actually seeing in real time and have a chance to do something about, to understand and to take action. This notion of an espionage machine party when you think about Peter Strzok's central role, both in preserving Hillary Clinton's viability as a candidate in his role as the email point man, the email scandal investigator, and then his role, it seems, in shepherding, if you will, the dossier emanating from the Kremlin, from former British intelligence agent Christopher Steele, from DNC contractor GPS Fusion, this central role that takes in the Justice Department and the FBI and the Democratic Party, we're just looking at this espionage machine party that is designed to preserve the ruling party in charge, not the rule of law.
And to the extent that that is the case, Diana, it really does, as you say, cut to the quick the whole idea of a republic in which people can be confident that they're voting for representation they choose and want to govern them. And it does seem to me striking that we're now hearing the concerted complaints of a lot of people in the Democratic side insisting that this is all about trying to protect the president, that the Republicans are somehow making out of whole cloth something from this sort of evidence, simply because Bob Mueller's investigation is tightening the noose, as it were, on the presidency. Your thoughts on that subject?
Right. Well, of course, there is an aspect to this that deeply affects President Trump. It is his presidency that was conspired against. It goes to a much broader implication for the entire country, for the American people, because what we're seeing here are the departments of justice, security, FBI, not preserving the rule of law, but preserving the ruling party, and indeed poisoning the whole concept of elected government, of a presidential election, of transparency, of rule of law. I mean, when the word coup comes up, this is a form of staging a coup when the elements of the government are no longer bound by their law, by their roles, by their duty to the Constitution and to the people of this country, but to a ruling party. That is when you are seeing the seizure of power. And so this is what we are starting to understand. And there are so many more questions, and it goes so much more deeply than what we can so far see. But this is a unique moment in history to try to understand and take action against those perpetrators.
Yeah. And the idea that there's nothing to see here, folks, move along, is deeply sinister as well, and cynical, to say the least. Diana, just very quickly, we only have a minute and a half left. What are your thoughts about the new national security strategy that the president has rolled out?
Yes, well, it does have that feel of a breath of fresh air, given the design and given the formation of it, with its concerns for Sharia, with its concerns for protecting this nation, as opposed to what we've seen for the past more than 8 years. So I was very pleased with it and hope to see aspects of it enforced. But going back to our original conversation, nothing will happen if we don't. The most important issue of the day is what went wrong with the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Obama White House, the Hillary campaign, foreign intelligence, and the Kremlin. And it wasn't Russian collusion in the Trump campaign. But this is the most important story of our time.
It certainly is. And as we focus on both that story and what we're supposed to be doing now with respect to a national security strategy and the government's policies more generally, it just underscores the importance of personnel, the importance of the president having people around him and working for him who support what he's trying to do and who will assist him in bringing to heel the deep state and others who are dead set against his program. Diana, that goes to the heart, as you say, of the republic. I appreciate all you have done in 2017 to help support it and teach the rest of us about threats to it. We look forward, as I said earlier, to continuing these educational briefings in the new year ahead. In the meantime, enjoy the holidays. God bless you. keep up your great work at dianawest.net, and we'll see you in 2018. Next up, we'll talk with Fred Flights. We'll get a little bit more on this national security strategy and how it appears we are watching Iran moving into a hot war. Will we be in it? Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, Fred Flights. He is a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency. He also served as Ambassador John Bolton's Chief of Staff in the State Department and as a professional staff member in the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author of Obama Bomb, a great and growing national security fraud, and countless articles. You can find them in all the right places, National Review, Newsmax, Fox News, and the like. Also, Fred is a regular guest on many of the most important television programs of the country, and certainly the most important radio show, this one. It's always good to have him back. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Good to be here, Frank.
Well, let me start, Fred, by asking you, as a man who has covered closely, both in your previous incarnations and now with us at the center, developments in Iran, and in particular, the growing danger that we face as a result of Barack Obama's folly in providing both legitimacy and funding to the regime through this Obama bomb deal. We now have Iranian proxies attacking Saudi Arabia, its capital city, Riyadh, and attacking us through the Hezbollah drug running operations aimed at this country. What are we to make of what the Iranians are up to? And are you concerned, Fred, that we are inching, if not actually galloping, towards conflict with the Iranian Republic?
Well, Frank, I tried to explain in my 2016 book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, which you can obtain on our website, securefreedom.org, that, frankly, President Obama was prepared to give away anything to get this deal. He had told the Iranians that the United States was not going to continue to push for the overthrow of Syrian President Assad. It looks like, it looks very much like that the Obama administration decided to stop an investigation into drug running by Hezbollah, which included smuggling cocaine into the United States and money laundering. This is something called Project Cassandra. The Drug Enforcement Agency was about to pounce on them. Politico just revealed that apparently, we decided, the U.S. government decided not to pursue this. And now we have instances of the Houthi rebels, which are a proxy group in Yemen, being funded and armed by the Iranians. And we know they're being armed by the Iranians because armed shipments from Iran to the Houthis have been intercepted. And this isn't a question. Have fired missiles at Saudi Arabia. Now, the Houthis didn't simply find these missiles out of thin air. These are sophisticated devices. They obviously came from Iran. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley was exactly right this week, which she made a fantastic presentation, given the evidence that there's only one place these missiles should have come from. And this all stems from the Obama administration's policy to basically not look at all the threats that Iran poses because of their desperation to get a legacy nuclear agreement for Barack Obama. This is the result of that terrible policy.
Yeah. And just to come back to my basic question, can that policy result in armed conflict with Iran? Certainly between the Saudis, I would guess, and others in the region, but probably also us as well.
I think the chances are increasing every day. President Obama said that Iran would become, we would normalize relations with Iran. It would join the community of nations due to this nuclear deal. That's not what happened. Iran sent troops into Syria. It stepped up its harassment of ships in the Persian Gulf, and there were missiles fired at ships in the Red Sea, including against American ships by the Houthi rebels. They fired more missiles, including a missile that said Israel must be wiped off the map. At least because of miscalculation, there's a chance of a military conflict. But with missiles being fired at Saudi Arabia, there's a real chance that there could be a hot war fairly soon between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
And we may be pulled into it. Let me ask you, Fred Flights, to reflect on all of this in the context of the national security strategy President Trump unveiled earlier this week. We were just talking a little bit about it with Diana West. I'm interested in your take on the question, as I see it, of not so much whether this is a sound strategic plan, very much reminiscent of what he actually campaigned on, but whether it will now be implemented any more than his campaign promises were during his first year in office, I think because he's foolishly, or at least mistakenly, invested confidence in people who have proven to be insubordinate subordinates.
I mean, that's the sad reality about this plan. It was a brilliant strategy that solidified what Keep America Safe and America First means. I mean, I think it was a very solid and detailed explanation that puts to bed a lot of unfair criticisms of the president. But you're exactly right. This strategy doesn't mean anything unless the president puts in people who believe in it and are prepared to fight for it within the U.S. government. I make this point in an op-ed that ran in The Hill yesterday. It's crucial that the president staff the government with people who support his positions and that he remove people who obviously do not support his agenda and that had been fighting against him every single day. I mean, on the Iran deal, on the Paris Climate Accord, on trying to put references to the global jihad movement and jihadists in his speeches. There's people in the National Security Council who keep taking these references out. One has to wonder, why are people who could have been in the Obama administration serving in the Trump National Security Council?
Well, I know why they're serving there. They are serving there to obstruct the president's policy and subvert it to the extent they can. The real issue is, why are they being tolerated? My prayer is, and I agree with you on, I think, the soundness of this strategy and the need for its effective implementation, Fred Flights. I just pray that the president will not suffer this kind of insubordination any longer and will bring into his National Security Council team, most especially those who believe in it and want to help him succeed with it. Fred, let me turn to one other issue before we have to let you go. You've spent time, as I mentioned, on Capitol Hill periodically over the past year. We have talked from time to time about the House IT scandal, the information technology systems penetration, at least the Democrats' part of it, by Pakistani nationals who there is reason to believe have engaged in criminal conduct and possibly even espionage. Where are we on this scandal, really, and why are we not hearing more about it from the congressional leadership and investigators?
Well, I don't think the mainstream media wants to pursue a story that suggests that foreign intelligence agencies had penetrated congressional computer systems because of, frankly, the stupidity of senior Democrats. There are new reports that the individuals involved in this had their own personal business. I think one was a car dealership. Huge amounts of money were involved, Frank. And I understand there now are concerns that this may have been some effort to raise money for foreign terrorist organizations. Have you heard details about that?
Well, Luke Rosiak, who has been doing extraordinarily impressive work on all of this at the Daily Caller, Fred, has a story out today in which he connects the dots, I think it's fair to say, between the Hezbollah caper, which you spoke a moment ago, their drug running and money laundering operations in the United States, and apparently this car dealership of Amran Iwan, who has, I think, become now pretty squarely into focus as the ringleader of this Pakistani IT caper. But the question, Fred, is really, is that the extent of it, or is that just yet another indication that something is seriously wrong here and that we need a comprehensive, rigorous, and public inquiry into what the degree of the compromise was and who has benefited from being able to provide IT services, shall we say, to somewhere between 20 and maybe as many as 60 Democratic members of the House of Representatives. This is a story we'll be following closely, I know, in 2018, and I look forward to working with you on it and so much more. Fred Flights, Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, thank you for your continuing service to our country and your friendship. Have a great holiday season, and we'll talk with you in the new year. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take his temperature on this national security strategy as it relates to China. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our friend Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving Asia. He is a columnist for the Daily Beast, the author of two terrific books, very much timeless books for that matter, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. It is always a delight to have him with us. It has been an extraordinary run of the past 12 months. Gordon, thank you for all of your service to us over 2017. And of course, we look forward to an even better 2018 with you. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
Let me ask you first, Gordon, to comment from your perspective on what the president had to say in his national security speech this week and the strategy that he was addressing concerning China in particular, notably the importance that he's assigning to economic measures to counter what is, I think, now pretty widely agreed is economic war being waged against this country by the People's Republic.
The National Security Strategy, which was released on Monday, is an historic document because what it does is it's realistic. For the first time, we have an NSS, which describes the world as it is, not the world that foreign policy establishment types want it to be. What it does is he looks at both China and Russia and calls them revisionist powers. And then, although not specifically naming Moscow and Beijing, talks about their extremely dangerous behavior across the board. And he also talks about economic aggression. When the document uses that term, it doesn't specifically link it to Beijing and Moscow, but effectively it does. And that's an important step forward. A lot of people don't like the national security strategy, not only people in China and in Russia, but also in this country as well. But I think it's an important step forward in having honest conversations about the way the world is at this moment. And clearly, I think the administration and Nadia Sachlow, who was responsible for shepherding this through the administration, really deserve great credit for putting this out there.
I do, too. Overall, I think it's a terrific document. I particularly found impressive and encouraging the element of economic warfare that the president seems prepared to engage in to defend our vital interests. The Chinese and Russians are not happy about it, not surprisingly. They've critiqued it as isolationist and a return to the Cold War and imperialistic, Gordon. To the extent that you've had a chance to sort of evaluate this, is this signaling, in fact, a recognition that America is back and they're not happy about that? Or do you think that they're perhaps anticipating that this may turn out to be more empty rhetoric and that they can discourage its implementation by denouncing it?
Yeah, I think they certainly want to discourage implementation. Also, there's a fair amount of misreading of what actually is in the national security strategy, because it does reaffirm traditional American goals. As I guess I've said on this program, you know, I'm not terribly crazy about the phrase America first, but what this document does is it lays out a coherent justification for the use of that phrase. And essentially what it is the United States, first of all, has a responsibility to its own people. That's the highest responsibility. Also, it talks about strengthening America so that America can then go out and defend the American-led international system. And that is traditional American foreign policy. It's not as far from, you know, what we have heard in previous administrations as people would like to characterize it. There's a certain amount of anti-Trumpism, and so therefore, no matter what the president does, will receive excessive criticism. But I think this document lays out a very coherent and important strategy. And at the core of that, as you point out, is America's economic strength. Because without economic strength, we cannot have a military. Without a military, we cannot have a peaceful world. So there's important linkages in here. You know, I would argue about certain things in the NSS. I would put emphasis in different places. But nonetheless, this is something important for the American people to think about, to read. I know it's 68 pages, but nonetheless, as you go through line by line, it is an impressive document.
It is. I agree. Gordon Chang, let me switch gears with you. North Korea, the subject of your book, Nuclear Showdown, is very much on our minds. It did not have quite the prominence that I thought it might in the national security strategy, but perhaps that's because the president has come to the conclusion that China is, after all, the enabler of this and the problem as a result. But there's a lot of sort of to-ing and fro-ing on this. I remember that, I think it was last week now, Rex Tillerson was basically pleading with the North Koreans to come back to the table to talk about anything, even the weather, he said. On the one hand, on another, we had Tom Bossert, the president's homeland security advisor, coming out and holding the North Koreans directly accountable for unleashing on the world, not just us, but on the world, this so-called WannaCry virus or malware. And then there's this summit coming up in Canada, the 16th of January, in which apparently the nations that waged war against North Korea the last time are being summoned and are supposed to demonstrate their solidarity. Give us a sense of where things stand at the moment and where we should be going.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that because there's a lot happening at the moment. First of all, with Thomas Bossert, you know, it's important for the United States to publicly hold North Korea accountable for the WannaCry virus. I mean, there's been a little bit of disagreement about who is responsible for this, but it is probably the North Koreans from what at least is in the public domain, and it was important for the administration to publicly state that. I would have liked to have seen if there was help that North Korea got from other nations with WannaCry. So, for instance, at that time, North Korea's only internet pipeline to the world ran through China. And we also know that North Korean hackers are openly based on Chinese soil, especially in Shenyang, the Chinese city.
These would be clues of that complicity, would it not?
Yeah, in the domain, open domain, we don't have very much evidence of complicity of other countries. But the reason why I talk about this was because in the Sony Pictures Entertainment hack in November of 2014, we had the Obama administration say no other country was involved, when that clearly was not the case, because the Sony hack was launched from Chinese IP addresses. And because of China's great firewall, they know everything that goes on in an internet sphere inside of China. So they had to know that the North Koreans were attacking Sony. They had to see the hundreds of terabytes of data that were exfiltrated from Sony through the Chinese firewall to the North Korean hackers. This was a failure of the first order on the part of the administration then not to name the Chinese. So I would like to know if there was any other country involved in WannaCry. And clearly, this is a continuing sore. You mentioned that in the national security strategy, there's not that much mention of North Korea, and that's true. It's also true of Iran. But part of that, I would guess, is the fact that, look, North Korea and Iran, yeah, they're dangerous. But they wouldn't be dangerous at all if it weren't for their big power sponsors. So North Korea is the paw, China is the cat, as a retired Indian general said a few days ago in Tokyo.
Indeed. And Gordon, just very quickly, are we to expect anything out of this idea that there will be a diplomatic solution as a result of this summit meeting in Canada or Tillerson's appeal?
Yeah, most people don't think so. I think that it's important, though, for us to talk to other countries to apply pressure to North Korea, because the administration's sanctions efforts over the last month or so have really been flagging.
Yeah, this is critical to it, needless to say. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. And I think for the rest of this year, unfortunately, we will look forward to talking with you next year, however, early and often, and appreciate so much the great work you do at the Daily Beast and elsewhere. Thank you so much for spending your time with us week upon week. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you, however, again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.